from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's forum program, one of the world's most distinguished biblical translators and scholars, UC Berkeley's Professor Robert Alter, will join us in studio for a discussion of his newest work, a translation and commentary on the wisdom books of the Bible. That is Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. We'll include your calls, emails, and online responses coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Professor Robert Alter, who has translated the Book of Psalms and the Five Books of Moses, has now published a translation and commentary in the three books of the Old Testament designated as the Wisdom Books, Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. The poet Seamus Heaney calls this latest work of Robert Alter's a godsend, and James Woods of The New Yorker writes, quote, "Alter takes us back to the essence of the meaning." One of the world's most eminent scholars and translators of the Old Testament, Robert Alter is the class of 1937 professor of Hebrew and Comparative Literature at the University of California, Berkeley, and recipient of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Lifetime Achievement and the Penn Center Literary Award for Translation. He joins us in studio for this forum hour. Welcome. Glad to have you
I'm
back.
I'm delighted to be here again.
Well, I am delighted to have you back. I mean, this is extraordinary work, as your past work has been. And what you keep realizing is, in reading your work, is just how much the Bible is really an anthology.
Oh, absolutely. It spans 8 or 9 centuries.
It's not only the spanning of time, but, here you have three new, new books in terms of translating, three books designated as the wisdom books, and they're all different from each other, and they're all different from so much else in the Bible.
Yeah, especially, of course, Ecclesiastes and Job. I mean,
should we give Ecclesiastes his right name as you do?
Oh, okay. It'll be a lot. We'll save a lot of air time. It's Kohelet, that most biblical scholars now use the Hebrew name. So Kohelet, one last time for listeners, Ecclesiastes and Proverbs are really very different from everything else in the Bible. Proverbs, in form, it's different from most of the Bible. In terms of its assumptions, it's kind of with the mainline view in the Bible. That is, if you're a good person, you'll be rewarded. If you're an evil person, you'll be punished. And if you see that wicked guy who is worth $50 million and living it up, it's only an illusion. He's going to get his. That is the
justice and divine justice reigns.
Right,
right. Yeah.
And that is particularly what Job argues against. He looks around and he says, it doesn't make any sense. And so he says, well, that's his argument with God. You're supposed to be a just God. Where is the justice?
In fact, Job in some ways is really, well, deeply questioning of God's justice, profoundly questioning of God's justice, and maybe intimating that it's terrible injustice from the divine.
You know, there are passages in Job where he actually arraigns God for being perverse, not just injustice. He says, you blind the eyes of judges and pervert the counsel of the wise and so on and so forth.
It's also true, I suppose, first of all, Job is not an Israelite, and what one learns about these three parts of the scripture is there's little in them that is specifically Israelite. Or what we would associate with the other scriptures.
Right. This is, maybe I should explain.
Yeah, let's talk
this,
about the wisdom literature.
The wisdom label. Yeah. The Bible doesn't call them wisdom, although the word wisdom pops up in a lot of these books. It's an after-the-fact label that scholars have come up with, but I think it's, on the whole, quite convincing, which is as follows. there was an international literary intellectual activity in the ancient Near East, of which there are expressions in Egypt and Mesopotamia and ancient Israel, where there were probably schools where a teacher and students investigated questions of what is the good life, what is value, and so on and so forth. Now, the perspective of wisdom literature, wherever it appears, is universal, not national. And thus we have in the Bible, basically, in these three wisdom books, no references to the God of Abraham, no references to the covenant, to the revelation on Mount Sinai, to the destiny of the people of Israel. But these general considerations are investigated. And, of course, this is especially striking in Job, where, as you said, you have Job and his three so-called friends who are not at all Israelites.
And in fact, God is called Elohim in Ecclesiastes or in
right. And
as
actually,
opposed to Yahweh. Or,
and he's called in the body of the book of Job, not in the voice from the whirlwind at the end. He's invariably called either Elohim or there's a kind of shorter poetic form of that, Eloah, but not Yahweh.
And you mentioned the voice from the whirlwind. I mean, this is it's pretty magnificent and spectacular poetry. I mean, because it comes from the whirlwind,
right?
And so much of this translation had you in the role of really translating the poetry, and some of it is pretty extraordinary poetry. I mean, and passionate poetry.
Oh, absolutely. Now, it was a little scary, but also exciting to translate the poetry of Job, because for my money, it's the greatest poetry in the Hebrew Bible, and I think that that the Job poet really is among the great poets of the Western tradition. I mean, I would line him up with Dante and Shakespeare, some of the poetry is quite breathtaking. Now, of course, I don't claim to be a poetic genius like the Job poet. And in any case, you can't produce an equivalent in translation. But what I did try to do is this poetry, the language is very concrete, and it's very compact and rhythmically powerful. So what I try to do as a translator is to tamp down the many syllables and the verbiage of the English language and get something, I didn't always succeed, obviously, roughly equivalent to this muscular compactness of the Hebrew.
But you also have, I guess, one of the best examples in your translation, I mean, in terms of an example that people would readily recognize and be aware of is, you know, vanity, all is vanity, becomes, in Ecclesiastes, breath, mere breath. And it connotes and denotes so much different than the word vanity that one wonders if you're going by the King James, and many fundamentalists are,
yes.
And they're saying, this is what I believe, this is the word of God, after all, you know, it becomes, quite challenging.
Yeah, well, I believe that the King James choice of vanity comes from the Vulgate, the old Latin translation, where it's vanitas, which, of course, is vanity not in the sense of the man who looks in the mirror and is preening his mustache, but in the sense of emptiness. And that really is one of the meanings, but only one of the meanings that the Hebrew term has. Here's the special stylistic issue of biblical Hebrew. It has very few abstract terms. So what the writers do, and the author of Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, does, is to use metaphors where other languages, certainly modern English, would use an abstraction. So he, in order to express his despairing sense about life, he calls everything, and then he uses the Hebrew word hevel, which means the exhaled breath. And I couldn't quite call it breath flat out because that didn't sound right in English. So what I did was call it mere breath. And then when it appeared in the superlative, I called it merest breath. The advantage of that is that the metaphor, unlike the abstraction, covers a number of overlapping concepts. I mean, it covers vanity in the King James sense. It covers futility, evanescence, lack of substance, and so forth. And for me, that's part of the beauty of the original.
It's much more sensible, I suppose, yeah, in terms of the original, and much more connects with the original. And the thing about these three books, these wisdom books that you're translating and really giving us, as James Wood said, the essence of the meaning of, is that they share a kind of value with, well, I suppose that gets back to the international that you spoke of, with Greek. I mean, here's Matthew Arnold who tells us we've got Hebraism and Hellenism and whatever the twain, but they kind of meet in a convergence here.
Right. Now, some people, you know, have thought that both Job and Kohelet are influenced by the Greek. They're very late books. I think that the case for Job is not at all persuasive. Kohelet, well, I don't know. I mean, some of the Safiist philological scholars think that the language puts it in the early part of the 4th century BCE, which would be before Alexander the Great conquered the Middle East. For example, there are no Greek loanwords. But it's possible that Kohelet was aware of Greek philosophy. Some of it sounds suspiciously like Stoicism, so it's a possibility.
Is it also a possibility that the books of wisdom were infused with other kinds of traditions as well? Because there were books, these kind of wisdom books, in so many other cultures.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's no question that they were infused with ideas, motifs, in some cases.
I keep thinking Gilgamesh and Noah, that kind of thing.
Well, no, I'm thinking specifically of Egyptian and Mesopotamian wisdom literature, which goes way back. For example, there is a set of chapters, about 4 or 5 chapters, in the Book of Proverbs, which scholars since the early 20th century have demonstrated is a kind of rough translation or paraphrase of an Egyptian wisdom text that goes back well before the Bible, maybe 5 or 6 centuries before the Hebrew Bible. So there you have something very direct. There are, when you think of Job, there are a couple of wisdom texts in Mesopotamia that raise questions about why the just suffer. So that might be somewhere in the background of Job.
Now, we'll get back to the wisdom books in a moment, but who better to ask this question than Robert Alter? I think Freud had this idea that Adonai, God in Hebrew, came from Aton, the Egyptian god, transliterated. Any credence to that? Or do you buy that?
Well, I don't buy the transliteration. I mean,
in other words, it would say monotheism was in Egypt before it was in the land of the Israelites.
Well, this is, as you know, Freud and Moses and monotheism floats this idea, which was not original with him. It was around in German biblical scholarship in the early 20th century that Moses was an Egyptian.
Even the name was Egyptian. Moses.
It certainly is. Yeah, Moses was an Egyptian, that he adopted this idea of the worship of one god only in this temporary revolution that took place under Amenhotep the 4th, I think it was. Who knows? I don't exclude the possibility. There's, from what one can make out, that Egyptian theological revolution was not exclusively monotheistic, but there was one supreme god. However, I have to also confess that we're getting into a large question of biblical theology, which goes back behind the wisdom books. I think, as many scholars do, that the pure monotheism, the kind of monotheism we would associate, say, with Thomas Aquinas or Maimonides, evolved by stages in the biblical period. And in a very old poem, like the Song of the Sea in Exodus 15, when the poet says, "Who is like unto you among the gods, O Yahweh?" What he's really saying is, well, there may be other gods, but they're penny ante gods. You know, you're the real...
The king of kings.
Yeah.
Talking to Robert Alter, his new book, he's professor of Hebrew and comparative literature at UC Berkeley, and his newest book is titled The Wisdom Books, Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. Actually, Ecclesiastes kind of refutes Genesis. Get into some maybe almost Darwinian ideas in Ecclesiastes.
Well, you'll have to explain to me a minute where you see the Darwinism.
Well, it's kind of subversive skepticism in some
way. Oh, yeah, sure. I would say the clearest way that you can see an argument with Genesis is in the concept of time. Because Genesis, especially in the first account of creation, right up at the front of the first chapter of Genesis, has this wonderful notion of progression through time, which you first can see in the acts of creation. You have 6 days in which, in orderly progression, different things are created, and then God rests on the seventh day. And that, in turn, becomes a kind of model for history in which things are going to progress to a grand fulfillment. That's something that's not in Genesis.
It's all linear.
Yeah, right. The prophets pick that up. What does Kohelet say? He says, things go round and round, and they don't get anywhere. All the waters go into the sea, and the sea is not filled. The sun rises, and the sun also sets, and so forth.
And in Proverbs, there's really a kind of probing of a moral universe, but it's really grounded in the quotidian. I mean, in what we would call the everyday, the ordinary.
Oh, absolutely. I would say, very pragmatic. There are pieces of very practical advice don't stand bond for somebody else because you'll lose your shirt.
That particular phrase, lose your shirt?
No, I'm afraid that's not there. But you will become impoverished, it does say. Now, the pragmatic orientation of Proverbs is particularly interesting in the sexual sphere, because there are repeated warnings to stay away from the stranger woman. And the stranger woman appears to be not a professional prostitute, but somebody else's wife. But
do they know about herpes? Or
No. There might be a hint in a couple of places that
social
disease might follow. But there is never a hint that committing adultery is a sin. I mean, that maybe the writer assumed it was, but he doesn't say so. What he says is, you'll get yourself into trouble. There's going to be a very angry husband. He might wring your neck, literally. If you want to keep safe, just don't mess with this kind of woman.
It's a kind of caveat, really, isn't it?
Right.
What would you say the value of these wisdom books is today, to particularly maybe to secular-minded people? I mean, you're talking about just practical advice and pragmatic advice in Proverbs. I mean, but these are kinds of things that we
have
become part of our popular culture almost. What's the value as you see it?
Well, I suppose that of the three books, the two that speak most directly to modern readers are Job and Kohelet. Proverbs, there is some of the witty and shrewd advice, and part of the force of the book is that these one-line proverbs that have a kind of point, or like almost a punchline. So the The shrewdness may speak to us at times, but it doesn't seem to be anything terribly profound. Whereas if you look at Kohelet, he raises this question that I think most reflective people who are not living in a Pollyannish world, at least part of the time, think, is there any point to everything that we're doing, everything we're striving for? What, after all, is value in human life? And it isn't entirely negative. I think it's mostly
pretty negative.
Yeah. Right? The one thing which does speak to me personally also, he says, well, your life is short and there's nothing else afterwards. That is, there seems to be almost a polemic, maybe in Job as well, against a new doctrine of the immortality of the soul. Your life is short and there's nothing else afterwards, and things go round and round and don't go anywhere. So what do? If you're lucky enough to be blessed with the good things of life, a jug of wine, a loaf of good bread.
And thou.
right, and thou, that's right, and a woman whom you love, that's what Kohelet says, then enjoy them while you can. And that's...
So the wisdom of Omar Khayyam.
Right, exactly.
There it was in the Bible centuries before. And from Job, I mean, you know, there have been so many dissertations and so many scholarly analyses of Job and conversations and so forth. But how does Job... I guess Job maybe applies to us today just in the sense of... I was thinking about Job as having the worst run of bad luck of anybody... At least
it's pretty bad, yeah.
and it's just maybe it's a sense of being resilient with bad luck, or dealing with bad luck, or enduring it somehow, sustaining oneself as opposed to checking out.
Well, I would say that he sustains himself by his sense of moral outrage against the universe, and that probably speaks to many of us in the 21st century more. Then the answer, if it's not exactly an answer, the voice from the whirlwind, as magnificent as the poetry of the voice from the whirlwind is, that is, we live in this world where a dear friend is stricken with a terrible disease, or a child is born with some awful deformation, and... there's no way to explain it. You can't say it's because such and such a person was not living a good life.
Well, Leibniz explained it, didn't he?
Yes,
it's all for the best of all possible worlds.
Right,
God,
right.
God has a design, and we just can't perceive it. Yeah.
Yes, I think that Leibniz was not as profound a thinker as the Job poet.
Well, he's a good mathematician at any rate.
Sure.
We're talking to Robert Alter and his new book. It's a wonderful book. It's the wisdom books, Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. And, well, talking about what we learn and even learn today from those books, but you may want to join the conversation and perhaps talk about something you've learned from them, or maybe tell us what you continue to learn from the Bible, or why you maybe disdain it. And we're talking also about just that extraordinary gift that Robert Alter has to translate, and to translate poetry and make it vivid and make it palpable and alive for us. Feel free to join the program. Your conversation is, in fact, invited. 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or email forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is biblical scholar and professor of Hebrew and comparative literature, Robert Alter. His new book, he's at UC Berkeley, by the way, is titled The Wisdom Books, Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. And I'm going to lean on him and ask him to read a couple of, passages from, read from the book, from the voice from the whirlwind, which is in Job. And of course, this is really the voice on high. Just a quick word of this, because we were talking about it off mic, about how there was an anthology of Holocaust literature called Voice from the Whirlwind that I recall, and it appeared after Richard Rubinstein's book, which was called After Auschwitz. And the whole sense of the voice from the whirlwind in connection with Job and the Holocaust has, I think, some bearing here, because that question, once again, of where was God became so prominent after Richard Rubenstein, this rabbi, said, you know, this compassionate, loving God, and all these not only Jews but gypsies, homosexuals, Catholics, and so forth, political dissidents were murdered wholesale by the Nazis. And so, in a way, it takes us back to Job, doesn't it? I mean, any kind of Bosnia, Cambodia, Rwanda, any of those kind of crises, horrors of our civilizations. What are you going to read for us?
Okay, I'll read the first 8 or 9 lines of the voice from the whirlwind. I'll just say one thing about it. As a literary person, when I look at this, I think this poet took a chance that only somebody supremely confident of his own genius could do, which is he'd created amazing poetry for Job to express Job's anguish. He said, okay, now God's going to speak. What I have to do is trump Job's poetry. And I think he did. So let me just read the opening passage. Who is this who darkens counsel in words without knowledge? Gird your loins like a man that I may ask you and you can inform me. Where were you when I founded earth? Tell if you know understanding. Who fixed its measures? Do you know? Or who stretched a line upon it? In what were its sockets sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Who hedged the sea with double doors when it gushed forth from the womb, when I made cloud its clothing and thick mist its swaddling bands?
Okay, no comment.
Oh, I
have. You have comment, yes.
Just, I can't resist this. Job is, the poet that is, not the character, is amazing in his metaphorical inventiveness. And this business of swaddling bands is breathtaking. That is, I think the image is of the primordial sea at the moment of creation, and these strips of white mist or fog hanging horizontally over the face of the waters. And of course, it brings in a wonderful birth image, which responds to Job's death wish poem at the beginning of the book, in which he wants his birth wiped out.
And what is that swaddling metaphor in the King James?
I don't recall.
It's not that, though.
Yeah.
Let me go to our callers. And we begin with Anne. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted, by the way, I love this show. I'm glad that Forum isn't afraid to take up a religious topic. I got to say, I used to think Job was about the suffering, about suffering and why good people suffer. But once I went through some of those things, I realized it's a very astute and wise account of how those who have not suffered deal with the suffering of others. I mean, in the beginning, Job sits in the ashes and his friends are only helpful when they sit quietly with him. You know? And once they open their mouths, you know, then it's trouble. So it goes through all the kinds of things that, you know, it's relevant today, all the kinds of things that people say to the suffering, you know, that are so...
It's really a question about God's will more than anything else.
No, but this is an interesting point because those of us, say, if you've had somebody very ill in your family, you know, some people are very good with this. Some people really can't handle it. They don't know what to say, or they don't say anything, or they won't come to visit at the hospital because hospitals make them anxious. And so that's a very shrewd point.
Yeah, I think so, too. Anne, did you want to add another shrewd point or two? Or?
Oh, no. I think it's good for people to revisit that if they know someone who's suffering so they don't add to it. You know, a lot of what Job suffers throughout the book is what other people are saying about his initial problems.
But, you know, I've just written a book about faith, among other things, and I think that faith can give people great consolation and give them great comfort in time of tragedy. Job is not a book of comfort. It's not a book of consolation, really, ultimately.
No, the Job poet doesn't want to have anything to do with the kind of faith that makes you play with loaded dice with life and cook the evidence. Maybe that's a better metaphor. And just explain everything in terms of a prefabricated notion of moral cause and effect.
Ann, thank you for the call. And let me go to more calls. We go to Larry in San Jose. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I have a question for Dr. Alters. Regarding theodicy in the book of Job. And particularly, I was quite curious about the second chapter of Job, the 9th and 10th verse, and his dialogue with his wife after the catastrophes had befallen him, in which he says, should we not only experience goodness from God, but also trouble. He says, he replied to his wife, "You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" And it seems he's indicating that there's a duality in the grace of God. The grace to endure prosperity and goodness, and also the grace to endure suffering.
Do you read it that way, Bob?
Well, here we the caller's question or comment really gets us into a somewhat sticky issue. But I think since we're talking about Job, we can't really dodge this, which is there is a kind of disconnect between the frame story, which is in prose, that's the first two chapters and the last chapter, and the body of the book. Job's debate with his three companions, which is in poetry. Now, many of you out there probably have heard the phrase, the patient Job. Now, you might stop for a minute and say, patient Job? I mean, he is...
not meaning like a hospital patient, the patients of Job.
Yeah, right, the patients of Job. Right. Thank you for the clarification, Michael. So Job wanting to die and Job accusing God of being perversely unjust doesn't sound very patient, but it's the Job of the patient of the frame story to which the caller has just referred, who really is patient. These terrible things happen to him. His wife says, curse God and die. And he says, nothing doing. I mean, all things come from God. We have to accept the bad things together with the good things. Now, I believe, as do most scholars, that this is an old folk tale in which originally there were no three companions, and there was no debate. There was just a story about a man named Job who was very prosperous and was a good person, and terrible calamities befell him. He remained staunch in his belief, the patience of Job, and he was rewarded in the end. And that's what we get in the frame story. But the poet evidently took this story. I think he reworked it a little bit, but he didn't change any of the narrative data of the story. And into the middle of it, he broke into the frame, and he inserted this long, amazing, poetic dialogue debate. There, the issue of acceptance of suffering is not paramount as it is in the verse that the caller refers to.
Do you think it's something that kind of got shoehorned in there?
Exactly. A very big shoehorn.
Thank you. I remember, I think it was Cynthia Ozick who said, what happened to Job's other family? It just, you know, sort of disappears from the narrative, doesn't it?
Well, they all die except for the wife.
No, I know, but yeah. I mean, in terms of his mourning and his bereavement, he just goes on, in effect.
Oh, that's true. That's absolutely true, yeah.
Listener named Matt says, I've noticed a lot of Bible scholarship on TV these days, but it feels like the best work isn't what's making it there. The naked archaeologist comes to mind. Do you have producers coming to you asking for show ideas? Must we go to the effort of reading books to get the good work? Well, in this case, I see the name Robert Alter, yeah, and I jump. I mean, he just does such good work. It's a pleasure to have him on here. Brian writes on our website, what date does the author place on the writings he has translated? Well, different dates for different writings.
Okay, I'll run through that very quickly. The Book of Proverbs is an anthology, and in fact, it's an anthology of anthologies. It's made up of five units, and those are collections of proverbs. So the oldest one probably goes back to the reign of King Hezekiah, which would be the 8th century, late 8th century BCE. Some of the proverbs are later. There may be a few, since it's an anthology, that are earlier, and it's hard to date. Book of Job and Qohelet, Ecclesiastes are definitely after the return from the Babylonian exile, which occurred pretty much in the 5th century before the Common Era. My guess is that Job was composed somewhere in the 400s. How do I know this? Well, one linguistic piece of evidence is that there are quite a few loan words from Aramaic. And by this period, the Jews of Palestine were beginning to speak Aramaic instead of Hebrew. And Ecclesiastes maybe is at least a couple of generations, perhaps as much as a century later than Job.
You just brought something else to mind, though, when you're talking about the Babylonian captivity. What I was always astonished to learn many years ago was that when the Jews were in the Babylonian captivity, they brought back the idea of observing the Sabbath, which had not been necessarily part of their ritual or what they were doing in an observant way. And living under the Babylonian captivity also exposed them to the idea of, I suppose, what became Satan or Lucifer, because there's nothing in the Old Testament other than Gehenna that would make them see the devil in the way that they began to see the devil, which is really pretty much the way we see the devil now.
Okay, let me pick up on the devil. He's, as Milton knew, he's always very interesting to talk about or write about. You have in one of the, probably the next to the latest prophets, Zechariah, you have a figure who seems to be close to Satan. Now, in Job, this is by no means my innovation. It's been standard with biblical scholars for a while. The figure that the King James Version calls Satan is not Satan. He's not a diabolical figure in a mythological
or the
setting,
fallen angel or any of
or
that.
Any of that. He's never called. Satan is not a proper name in Job. He's always called the Satan. And a Satan is somebody who is a troublemaker, somebody who creates obstacles. So like many others, I've translated as the adversary with a capital A.
And by the way, we're talking to Robert Alter. His new book is The Wisdom Books. And at the time remaining, you'd like to join us, it's toll-free 866-733-6786. And you can also send an email to forum@kqed.org or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And we go to Karen. Karen, thanks for waiting. Join us. Hi.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much for these interesting shows that you're putting on, particularly this one. I just wanted to make the comment, it's been a while now, but at one point your guest was sort of summing up, I think, Ecclesiastes by saying, you know, it's a short, brief life and there's nothing after. So, enjoy, if you're lucky enough to have some things to enjoy, enjoy them. Is that kind of, you know, paraphrasing a little bit, but that's sort of where I understood him to say. But what I would say is, you know, rather than seeing that as disappointing, I would see it as illogical because, you know, in the world as we experience it through our limited senses, and especially since my background was in science, I can say that, you know, it's a very intricate world, even on, you know, from what we can see. And probably those events that happen that seem to have no cause, tragic things that are breaking our heart, it could be that this, you know, would imply a form and a function, the function being that there's, you know, existence continues beyond this span in the life, whether it be another life or another existence of some other sort that we don't understand. But then if you looked at it as a little segment of a continuum and something tragic happened, even if the child lived only a few hours or what have you, then you could say, well, what's the other thing that makes that make sense? And that would be karma, you know, cause and effect. And if you put those two things in the equation, it makes sense.
Well, you're talking really about sort of a Hindu belief that there is reincarnation or that souls are reborn and so forth. There's not much of that in the Bible. I mean, nothing that would even give evidence to.
Yeah, eventually the Jewish mysticism picks up that idea, evidently from India, according to the great authority Gershom Scholem, but there's nothing like it in the Bible. So I don't think that there's anything like karma in the books that I've been working on.
Although aren't mitzvahs a little bit like karma? I mean, why does one do a mitzvah, a good deed, if not for, well, the purpose of contributing something to the future?
Oh, well, yeah, certainly there's a sense of contributing to the future, but probably not so much in Ecclesiastes. That is, let me throw one other element into the mix. The biblical writers were, I think not just the writers, I think the biblical men and women in the street were very preoccupied with the notion of leaving a memory, especially because they didn't believe, in contrast to their Christian and Jewish heirs, that there was a life after death. Then what was important was that when you passed on, when you joined your ancestors, that you left something behind. The something behind being your deeds, your children and your children's children. So the greatest curse in the biblical world is to wipe out the memory, as in wipe out the memory of Amalek in the book of Exodus. So what does the author of Kohelet say? He says, there is no memory of what has been after we've gone. Everything is wiped out. So this is a really radical denial of something that biblical people hoped for.
It's almost nihilistic in a way, isn't it? Yeah. Let me thank you for the call. And let's go to another caller in Palo Alto. Earl, join us. Hi.
Thanks for this program. It's very interesting. I wanted to give a Jewish religious perspective on Kohelet, which seems to have been somewhat missing from the discussion so far. It does appear that Kohelet is an extremely nihilistic book, but at the very end of the book, it says the end of the matter is that you have to fear God and keep his commandments, for that's what man is supposed to do. So it appears that Shlomo HaMelech is standing everything on his head and saying, well, I tried wisdom, I tried pleasure, I tried this and I tried that, nothing worked out. So I guess basically what we have to do is keep the mitzvot of Hashem, of God, and that's how we have to live our life. And I also wanted to make one other comment that the description of Judaism as being a Western religion, I think, is a little bit of a misnomer. I think it's more Eastern than Western. But in any case, I just wanted to make the comment that while secular people might have trouble dealing with something like Qohelet and wondering why he's so nihilistic, the punchline comes at the very end, that after having done all of this, then the only thing to do is keep the Torah, like Moses told us to do. And so I just wanted to make that comment. That's all. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the call. Robert Alter.
Well, this, of course, is a matter of debate. There are, like our caller, some perfectly serious, reflective people who feel that those last seven or eight verses at the very end of Qohelet are intrinsic to the book and come from the pen of the author of Qohelet.
I thought he was bringing in the Marines or the cavalry.
Yeah, I go with the majority of scholars who feel that is often called an epilogue to Qohelet, and it seems to me that the
a different writer.
Yeah, that the piety of those verses is so much in contradiction to the body of the book that it's something that was inserted by an editor, a pious editor, in order, let's use a good Jewish term, in order to make the book kosher. And why would he do this? I think that this book, which is so radical in certain ways, is also so profound that Hebrew readers in the waning years of the biblical period did not want to let go of it. They didn't want to say that this is outside the canon. And so, but the editor, by inserting these affirmative, pious verses at the end, sort of saved the book for posterity. That's how I read it.
Let me get another caller on. From the Nevada desert, Norm, join us. Hi.
Hi, how are you? Okay. Very interesting discussion. I'm listening on satellite radio. I'm actually in the Great Basin Desert here, but I'd like to find out if the Old Testament addresses the concept of free will, and if that somehow interfaces with there's so much injustice due to improper use of free will that it justifies it hereafter.
Well, I don't immediately see the connection between the question of free will and the question of the hereafter. I would say that the majority view of the Hebrew Bible is that there is free will and that it is important to exercise it. For example, you have this great ceremony of the people of Israel at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, where they are set between these two different mountains, a mountain of blessing and a mountain of curse, and they say, I give you, God says, I give you this day life and death, and you shall choose life. So that seems to be a very emphatic expression of the idea of free will.
Let me thank the caller and go to some of your emails. Actually, Fred writes, here's another different kind of voice, a romantic notion that religion and the Bible are useful in 2010. It takes scholars to interpret desert wanderer nonsense from 5,000 years ago in a failed attempt to make it relevant. What a waste of an hour of public radio airtime.
Well, that's a clear-cut statement.
Yes, it is. Here's another clear-cut statement. Nice show. Whenever I hear of the Old Testament, I think of the following Richard Dawkins quote, "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction, jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully." Quote, unquote. Apparently, the wisdom books do not form the basis for the above quote. Richard Dawkins.
Well, I would say that there are many gods in the Hebrew Bible. That is because, as you pointed out at the beginning, Michael, this is an anthology and one that spans so many centuries. You have different viewpoints, different takes on God. The Dawkins catalog of indictment certainly is there, but there are very different views of God in the Hebrew Bible.
Eric writes, says, Dr. Alter read Robert Sachs' commentary on the book of Job, published in 2005. He suggests that God's questions at the end of the book point to a non-human world where morality, as we know it, does not apply. This contrasts with the world of politics and right and wrong, where most people live their lives bound by law. These worlds coexist, though we rarely venture into the former.
Well, there is something to that. I mean, the part of the vision of the voice from the whirlwind is that the whole notion of a world centered on humankind is off kilter, that there is this teeming world of animal life that we can't comprehend, and there's cruelty in the midst of nurture.
Well, it's always good to have you here, and notwithstanding Fred's comment, he and others might be warmed by the fact that Sam Harris will be with us later this week, author of books that essentially attack belief, atheist books. Robert Alter's book, again, for those of you who are interested in biblical scholarship or interested in the Bible and want to read really some of the beautiful poetry, no one would deny that that is the case. The wisdom books, Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. And again, Bob Alter is professor of Hebrew and comparative literature at UC Berkeley. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Tomorrow we'll have Douglas Rushkoff with us in this second hour, sort of a technological guru in many ways. And hope you will join us for that. Remind you that you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling 415-553-3300. Also want to thank our staff. Dan Zoll is our executive senior editor. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. It's not intern day. It's Paul Ancour at controls as engineer today. And thank our producers, Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.